You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, March the 16th, and this is the Friday Week in Review. We will welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk with us about the big news of the week, the big political news of the week, and we welcome your participation, too, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. And bring up a topic that happened in the news this week, please, if you call in. We are happy to have with us Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express, Milwaukee's alternative newspaper, a former Democratic state lawmaker. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, John.
Yeah, and John McAdams is also with us, associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Louis.
Well, let's start with some of the lead stories in the news this morning. I'm looking at this Associated Press story. A 2005 email exchange suggests White House political advisor Karl Rove may have had a hand in the process that resulted in the firing of a number of federal prosecutors. The one-page document released yesterday also indicates that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and his chief aide were considering dismissing as many as 20% of the U.S. attorneys. We have heard this week from a number of Congress people calling for Alberto Gonzalez's resignation, including New York Senator Charles Schumer.
We were told by the Attorney General that he would, quote, never ever make a change for political reasons. It now turns out that this was a falsehood, as all the evidence makes clear. That this purge was based purely on politics to punish prosecutors who were perceived to be too light on Democrats or too tough on Republicans.
All right, a politically motivated scourge, Professor McAdams?
Well, you know, if you go back to the Clinton administration, when Bill and Hillary took office, they fired all, I think it was 93 federal prosecutors, every last one of them, and replaced them with their own people, including particularly a crony of theirs in the Little Rock office. That would have been the office that would have investigated Whitewater. So the simple fact is that these people do serve at the pleasure of the president. Now, Schumer says this is, quote, political. What the Bush administration is saying is these were people who did not particularly want to prosecute and were lax in prosecuting vote fraud cases. Well, is that political? Frankly, it sounds to me to be a legitimate law enforcement concern. Mm-hmm. As for Rove being involved, who cares? The Attorney General, in fact, also, like these federal prosecutors, serves at the pleasure of the president, and there's simply nothing wrong with one official in the executive branch. Mm-hmm. Conferring with another official in the executive branch.
But some people care that there seems to maybe be some sort of cover-up here to try to push this on Harriet Myers. It was her idea. No, it was his idea, and trying to indicate that Karl Rove had nothing to do about it, while these emails that are now out suggest he did.
Well, in any situation like this, you're going to get into some sort of elaborate he said, she said, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and who knows? The simple fact is that the president has the right to fire these people. If it was really for inappropriate political reasons, and remember, firing someone because they're lax in prosecuting vote fraud cases is, you could call it political if you want to, but it's a very legitimate law enforcement concern. That's, in fact, the key issue.
Now, Louis Fortas, what's your take on this?
Well, first of all, I think John knows better than to start out with that comment about Clinton fired all the U.S. attorneys. It's like Clinton got rid of the entire cabinet of George W. Bush. Every president does that. When they come in, they bring in their team. That's the way it works, and that's why we vote for certain people. We hope they do bring in their team. What's going on here is very, very different. This is a situation where they had their team in. Their team members that did get fired on their last reviews, all of them got very positive reviews. And then all of a sudden they get fired. I mean, the only thing that this reminds me of is Nixon back when he was under fire and before they impeached him, and the special prosecutor Cox, Nixon wanted him fired, And the only difference was back in those days, some of the Republicans in the administration had some integrity, like Elliot Richardson, who was Attorney General. He refused Nixon's order. He actually resigned. He said, I'm not going to fire Cox. And Nixon had to go through two other people till he finally found someone who would fire the special prosecutor. In this case, you have Gonzalez scheming there in the White House, and then he becomes Attorney General, and they fire these people that, I think Schumer is right on this, just basically weren't biased enough.
Yeah. Now, I've heard some commentators hinting that they think Alberto Gonzalez will be out of a job before the day is done. Do you think so, Louis Fortas?
I think he's going to have trouble surviving. I don't know if it's going to happen today, but I do think he's been lying. This is just on the heels of Scooter Libby getting convicted of four felony charges for lying, and now you have Gonzalez lying. And what's going on is this administration is really under fire. Again, it reminds you a lot of the Nixon days where, they're in trouble. They're in serious trouble, and they're lying, and they're squirming around doing everything they can. And I think Gonzalez is in big trouble.
I think Fortas should be ashamed of himself for saying that Scooter Libby lied. What we clearly had there was a prosecution by a prosecutor who, in all decency, should have simply folded his tents and gone home. He admitted there was, in fact, no crime whatsoever to lie about. Valerie Plame's name was leaked by Richard Armitage, but he felt he had to get somebody. The truth is, you can manufacture a case against almost anyone if you question them enough. If you question them enough, what you will find is they will contradict themselves, particularly if they're honest and don't have their story straight because they're trying to be honest with you. Scooter Libby's contradictions in his testimony were no worse than contradictions in several journalist accounts. But he was put on trial in the District of Columbia before a jury consisting probably entirely of Democrats who in the jury room were lamenting the fact that they could not get at Karl Rove. They could not get at Dick Cheney. And so what they finally had to settle for was convicting Libby. The Democrats have what essentially is a sort of little cottage industry in producing scandals and then touting the claims of scandal that they have produced, in some cases, completely out of whole cloth.
Yeah. Is Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez in trouble, though, John McAdams, and might he be forced to resign?
It's possible because, first of all, two things, two arguments, two counterarguments there. Bush is typically very loyal to his subordinates. On the other hand, the Bush White House might simply throw Gonzalez to the wolves simply to avoid an elaborate investigation on the part of the Congress, an investigation that probably wouldn't uncover anything genuine but would simply drag on and hog the headlines. So that is a possibility. Who knows?
Mm. I'll take one call on this subject, and we may move on to some other issues. Dave in Wanakee, hi.
Yes, hello. Good morning. Under the Bush administration, there have been 298 investigations of Democratic Party political figures versus 67 Republican Party political figures. I'd like to see if there's a correlation between those prosecutors that the Bush administration graded as loyal and the number of investigations of the Democratic political figures under their area.
All right.
The firing of federal prosecutors is an attempt to make the Justice Department a political weapon of the president. President Bush is culpable, and he should be impeached.
Well, Louis Fortas, do you think there's a correlation between those investigations and what's going on with the firings of these attorneys?
I think what is very clear is they want a very loyal group of people, and they looked at these individuals and, for example, the person in New Mexico who Domenici and Heather Wilson both pressured, and he wouldn't cave in. He was going to do the job properly. If he comes up with some indictments against Democrats, fine, but he wanted to do it in a proper way. They didn't like him doing it in a proper way because it conflicted with their political agenda of having something come out before an election, And so he was replaced. Yeah, I think it's highly political, and I think it's disgraceful. I think there's a lot of things that have happened in this administration that have been totally disgraceful.
Do you have some comments on that, John McAdams?
Well, just that Louis Fortas is able to name one case where maybe there was a political connection or maybe not. Most of this is, in fact, simply speculation. It's simply assumed by people who hate the Bush administration to begin with that this must have been political.
Let me ask you this, John. Will you support a proper investigation? So I assume you're supporting Leahy's attempts to get subpoena power and get all these people before the Senate under oath, and let's really find out what's going on. I'm assuming that you're going to support that. Is that right?
Well, actually, not necessarily. Back in the 90s, did you support a proper investigation of the Clinton White House, or were you on the side of the Clinton White House when the Clinton White House invoked executive privilege?
I'm interested in
answer my question, Lois.
I answer yes. I'm interested in the truth coming out. No, I didn't.
I
was not out defending the Clinton White House. I do think with the Clinton White House, I mean, it's real interesting. You think Scooter Libby shouldn't have been prosecuted for lying under oath about something?
Oath.
Let me finish about something that brought us into war. But yet you were very supportive of the impeachment of Clinton over something that was a personal private matter.
Well, first of all, I wasn't supportive of impeaching Clinton. I was pointing out at the time that the last thing Republicans should want is Al Gore running for re-election in 2000 with the advantages of incumbency. The so-called personal private matter was Clinton's pretty clear perjury in a federal judicial proceeding. But I was, and if someone can call Tom Clark, if he's still around, maybe he could remember to confirm this, I was saying in the 1990s, that the principle of executive privilege is a perfectly legitimate constitutional means of maintaining checks and balances.
Yeah,
although I will say that if the Bush administration cooperated, let's talk about Wisconsin.
Well,
what do you think about the Republicans in our Senate who wanted to look into the Busuwaki thing?
Well, let's talk about that a little later in the program when we talk about some state issues. I do. Should Karl Rove testify before Congress, Professor McAdams? What would be wrong with that?
Well, that's simply a prudential judgment on his part. First of all, what presidents should do, if they're highly principled, is maintain a stance of executive privilege. That is to say, Congress can judge the executive branch based on what they see from the executive branch, that is, on policy outcomes, but has no right to dig in the process. Now, it's true that lots of individual presidents, given a choice between sticking with principle or sticking with what's politically expedient, will go with what's politically expedient, which is to say to cooperate with Congress, to send people to testify. Frankly, it could go either way on that. I am saying that the whole principle of executive privilege, which, by the way, I was siding with the Clinton administration on in the 1990s, unlike Lewis. Lewis was siding with the Clinton administration in 1990s.
Yeah.
That is a legitimate constitutional prerogative of the president.
Let me take a short break. We will move on to some other issues as we review the news of the week with John McAdams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, and Louis Fortas, Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express, a former Democratic state lawmaker. 1-800-642-1234 if you would like to bring up some issue from the news this week. We'll talk about the various resolutions in Congress and congressional actions dealing with Iraq and troop withdrawal and funding coming up after this break. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. This is the Ideas Network. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 25 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, March the 16th. Join At Issue with Ben Marins after 4 this afternoon when it's Your Views on the News. You can call in and talk about any news story of the week during Your Views on the News after 4 o'clock. We're talking with Louis Fortas and John McAdams during this Friday Week in Review. It's a split decision for congressional Democrats pushing to get U.S. forces out of Iraq. After a resolution calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops by next March fell short in the Senate, Democrats say they may have lost the battle, but will still keep fighting the war. Senate Democrats say they will continue to argue that the course of the war has been unsuccessful. They will try again next week when they take up a bill that would provide more money for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, a House panel has approved an emergency spending bill, but it also calls for troops to be out of Iraq by September of 2008. The full House votes on that next week. Okay, this resolution that fell short in the Senate yesterday, a vote of 50-48 calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops by next March. Your reaction, Louis Fortas?
Well, I think that the Democrats will get most of their resolutions out of the House. They will not get probably anything out of the Senate. Right now, two Democrats have voted with the Republicans, and Joe Lieberman, who's basically kind of a Republican, also voted with the Republicans. So the Democrats did not even get a majority in the Senate. It's a real close. It's 51-49 in the Senate. So it's very close. But there's also the filibuster, and they can keep it from passing. So nothing is going to come out of the Senate at this point. However, the interesting thing is that right now the Republicans are in lockstep with the White House, and they're supporting the surge and the like. If the surge is not successful, and unfortunately most people feel it will not be successful, that will these Republicans continue to stick with the president, especially those up for re-election, or will they begin to pull back? And you saw in Vietnam, they begin to pull back, and you'll probably begin to see the same thing here.
John McAdams?
Well, so far the surge actually looks to have been successful. Deaths and attacks are, in fact, down. You know, who knows what it'll look like in a month. It is the case, though, that politically the Democrats are caught in a hard place. What they're finding out, that having won the 2006 election, is that actually having responsibility for policy is a mixed blessing at best, and often a bane, because they are unable. I mean, you know, they're two intellectually reputable, responsible positions on the war. One is simply pull out, and if the Democrats really wanted to do that and would vote for that, they could simply cut off funding for the war. The other is simply to see it through to victory, but they are kind of caught in the middle. They don't have a majority to immediately pull out and declare defeat. Because of their base, are unwilling to stick with the war and see it out to victory. So they're caught in the middle in a very, very clumsy situation politically.
I was going to say that there was a moment of agreement between John and me, and I wanted to take an opportunity to capitalize on that. Is simply that when you do have the responsibility and you are in the majority, it is a lot more daunting than being in the minority, where you can do whatever you want because you have no power. And then he went on to simplify the matter, and that's what our agreement had to kind of end in that sense, that it's more than, are you going to cut and run, or are you going to go on to victory? The problem is, most people, and this is including the military people, do not feel that this can be solved. This is going to be resolved in a military way. This is going to be a political settlement. This is going to be a political solution. And the question is, how soon are we going to get to that, and how many more lives on both sides are going to be lost in this process?
But it's simplistic to say it's a political, because in a case like this, politics in Iraq certainly has to be part of the process. On the other hand, putting down people who would destroy the political process with force and violence is a part of the situation. So in any case like this, you need both a political solution, but you also need the military, in effect, covering for the political solution of stopping the people who would try to impose a violent solution from doing that, so that politics can maybe hopefully work.
My God, that seems to be agreement again, John.
Well, let's get in a caller here to shake things up. Al in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. What happened on these resolutions was that AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, had a big meeting. They had almost 200 representatives there, almost 50 senators. Some people were very astounded because the Prime Minister of Israel told them that if the United States would pull out of Iraq too soon, Israel would be endangered. And AIPAC has always said that, claim that it does not do the bidding of the Israeli government. But after this affair, then the Democrats started to fade, and that is why the resolution failed.
Is that why the resolution failed, Professor McAdams?
I'm not sure I completely followed the caller's arguments. He seemed to want to invoke the nefarious Jewish lobby or something. No, I don't think it failed particularly for anything having to do with Israel. I mean, I think Israel and Israel supporters are right to think that their survival is indeed tied up in the war against Islamic extremism. They're absolutely right about that, but I don't think that was a big part of the considerations in the U.S. And the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, and Louis Fortas, anything on that?
Yeah, I don't know where AIPAC was. I know that they're very close to the Bush administration, but I don't know, and they're very powerful. I don't know where they were on this.
Let's talk a little bit about U.S. Representative Dave Obey of Wausau and the the posting of a video on YouTube earlier this week or over the weekend when he was outside of his Capitol office with anti-war activists pushing him to try to end the war, and he got into a little bit of a war of words. Here's a clip from that exchange.
We ain't got the votes for it. We do have the votes. If you guys quit screwing it up, we do have the votes to end the legal authority for the war. That's the same as defunding it.
All right, Dave Obey did apologize maybe for some of the language used there, but he did not apologize for calling some of the anti-war activists idiot liberals, saying anyone who doesn't know the difference between defunding the war and ending it is an idiot liberal. What do you make of all this, Louis Fortas?
Well, you have a guy like Dave Obey who no one can accuse of being wishy-washy and not stating his opinion. He's a very passionate guy, to say the least. And I think what's going on is the people that he was talking to are very frustrated because they see this war going on, and they elected a Democratic majority, and they're feeling like, okay, now you folks should go in there and stop everything. And Obey, I think, is looking at it very much from a very experienced insider, saying, okay, this is how it's going to work, because this is the only thing we can get done, and blah, blah, blah. That's what they would be saying if they weren't yelling at each other. And so I thought it was the whole thing was kind of amusing.
Yeah. Professor McAdams?
Well, historically, both left and right have had their wackos on the extremes. I mean, if you go back to, circa 1960, it was William Buckley, a good staunch conservative, attacking the John Birch Society because of its extremism. Right now, the Democrats do indeed have a problem with what the blogosphere, the conservative blogosphere, calls moonbats on the left. That is, people who are not merely on the left, because after all, I mean, Obey is on the left, certainly on the war, but create huge problems with the relatively extreme and uncompromising positions and rhetoric and vehemence in attacking sometimes their own allies.
Let me take one call on this. Oh, it's not exactly on this. Tom and Sobieski, go ahead.
Hi. I want you to just look into the future, into the crystal ball. And the Iraqis right now are in the process of potentially turning over their oil fields to the Americans and the English. Would this, do you believe, be an excuse for our government to keep us in Iraq longer to protect the interests of these corporations?
Yeah, we did a program earlier this week with a guest who says the Iraqi parliament will be voting sometime probably this month on this Iraq oil law, which would turn over control of the country's oil to foreign companies and take most of it out of the hands of the government. This guest was saying this just goes to show that the war really was for oil. Professor McAdams?
Oh, gosh, this is moving. that stuff. You actually could argue reasonably that the first Gulf War was to a substantial degree about oil because Saddam Hussein had grabbed Kuwait and threatened Saudi Arabia. Look, before we went in to before we invaded to take Saddam Hussein out of power, we were getting oil. Remember, he had his so-called oil for food program, which actually was an oil for palaces program, an oil for bribes for French, Russian, and U.N. officials program, but the oil was getting into the international market. Frankly, I don't know exactly what the Iraq parliament has been considering, but I can assure you it's not just giving all these valuable oil fields to British or American firms. It's probably simply privatizing the operation, turning the technical operations over to firms that are technically proficient in doing that. That's what lots of governments do in lots of situations, and it's a very good policy.
Louis Fortas?
I have no idea whether the U.S. Went to war for oil. I don't want to believe that. But just look at the other reasons. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no connection with al-Qaeda. You begin to wonder why we actually did go to war, and I'm still kind of confused on that issue. I have no idea other than that it was some kind of a social experiment on the part of people like Paul Wolfowitz and that to show that they can or believe that they're smarter than the rest of the world and that they can create this domino effect of democracy. Short of that, I have no idea why we went and what role oil played in the whole deal.
Well, the Bush administration certainly believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction because everybody else believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, including the French government, the British government, including Hans Blix, including almost everybody believed
that they... Blix was saying, give me more time. Give me two more months, he said, and I would, and I'll know exactly, but we wouldn't wait. But anyway...
Blix explained to the U.N. That Saddam Hussein was under U.N. resolutions obligated to come clean about weapons of mass destruction that Blix knew perfectly well he had and told the U.N. that Saddam Hussein had not done that. Now, the fact that Blix did not want to go to war at the time doesn't change the fact that Blix thought Saddam, at least clearly led the U.N. to believe that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. The disagreement at the time was not about whether Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, but whether we should hold off some matter of more months for inspections, sanctions, et cetera, whether we should go to war at the time. There was no disagreement at the time about whether Saddam had weapons of mass destruction.
You could speculate whether there were weapons of mass destruction, or you could give Blix a couple more months and find out for sure.
The issue is what Bush administration believed.
Yeah, let's get into the news of this week still. For the first time this week, the U.S. military is describing some of the violence in Iraq as a civil war. The Pentagon report also states that October through December was the most violent three-month period in Iraq since 2003. Goes on to say that members of the Bush administration had been reluctant to say that this is a civil war in Iraq. So how significant is this, John McAdams?
It's completely insignificant. It's playing silly semantic games. It reminds me of the whole issue of the Kennedy assassination, where people argue was the wound in Kennedy's did he have a wound in his back or did he have a wound in his throat, which is a silly argument. The wound was at C-71. Mm-hmm. Let's be precise. The report actually says it had elements of a civil war. There's simply no doubt that Sunnis have been fighting Shia, and Shia have been fighting Sunnis. There's no doubt that there's that element of civil war. If you want to call it civil war, call it civil war. If you want to call it communal conflict, call it communal conflict. If you want to call it ethnic cleansing, call it ethnic cleansing. There's no doubt that those two groups have been at each other's throats.
Yeah, Louis Fortas.
I guess, there's no other way to describe it when you have Iraqis killing Iraqis other than the civil war. The sad thing is, and unfortunately, many people are beginning to realize that our presence there is actually exacerbating it. And I think if we did pull back and let the Iraqis, with the help of their neighbors and anyone else who has any kind of influence, try to bring us to some kind of political solution. Will there always be some extremists, as John will point out, that will be sniping at the edges? Probably until you kind of settle that down. But in the meantime, I think we should be pushing toward some kind of diplomatic, political, whatever you want to call it, situation solution rather than our being there inciting and inflaming the violence.
We will move on to some other issues after this break, including let's talk a little bit about what the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Peter Pace had to say about the don't ask, don't tell policy of the military this week. And we'll talk some about another firing or forced resignation in the Walter Reed scandal, as well as some state issues. 1-800-642-1234. If there's an issue from the news this week that you would like to bring up in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn. After 9 o'clock, Peter and his guest will discuss the theory that laughter is rarely an intellectual response to something funny, but rather an instinctive survival tool. So laughter, a scientific investigation coming up after 9 o'clock. Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn, by the way, because Kathleen is off at an awards ceremony. I don't think she would mind if I told you that the U.S. Postal Service, of all things, awarding Kathleen an award for being a woman who has put her stamp on Milwaukee. So congratulations to Kathleen. We are reviewing the news of the week with John McAdams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, and Louis Fortas, Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express, a former Democratic state lawmaker. And we welcome your participation as we talk about a couple of more national issues, and then we'll move into some state issues, state political issues. I wanted to ask you both your reaction to and the fallout from and the reaction to the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Peter Pace saying that he thought homosexuality was immoral. He did then say that he regretted putting his personal opinion into the debate, that he shouldn't have done that. He said he should have focused more on the Pentagon's policy about gays in the military and less on his personal moral views. However, some gay rights groups are still mad at him, saying that that his comments were outrageous, insensitive, and disrespectful. What do you think of that, Louis Fortas?
Well, first of all, to his credit, Peter Pace is a highly decorated military general leader and all. But he's also chief of staff. He's a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff is appointed by the president, in this case by President Bush. So why should anyone be surprised that Bush's choice is going to be anti-gay, since most of his whole administration feels that way? So, I mean, surprise, surprise.
John McAdams?
Well, certainly he has every right to his personal opinions, which are, after all, what Christianity is traditionally taught. Indeed, Islam has been even harsher on homosexuality. He was right in his not-apology, but sort of his non-apology to say he should have talked more about the public policy issues. And he did barely mention, but this got overlooked, issues of unit cohesion and morale. He should have talked about public policy reasons for don't ask, don't tell, as opposed to his moral views, which, of course, as again, he has every right to, but really aren't terribly relevant if you're talking about public policy of the military.
It is terribly relevant when you're in his position of such huge power, and you seem to have trouble with this line between my personal views and my policy views, and that's the part that's scary.
Yeah. Of course, I can't find there was another forced resignation in the Walter Reed Medical Center scandal, I guess. I think it was the Surgeon General Kiley was forced out. Louis Fortas, have we seen the end of the heads rolling on this one?
I don't know. I do appreciate the fact that the new Secretary of Defense is actually moving forward, trying to, I think, clean up this mess a little bit, and I'm real pleased to see that. I think I think the whole thing, and I think from people on both sides of the aisle, and everyone views this as absolutely disgraceful. You know, it's one thing to send these young heroes out to fight in Bush's war. And, I mean, the absolute minimum I think we owe these veterans, absolute minimum, is that if they're injured, they should come back to some decent medical care in a proper hospital setting and not a situation like we have at Walter Reed. So I think I don't think this is a political issue. I think this is just kind of a public disgrace.
Yeah. John McAdams?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with Lewis on that, and I'm thankful that I get my health care in the private sector where there are multiple and competing providers, and if I get poor health care, I have a choice.
Yeah. Well, John McAdams, you touched on this issue earlier in the program, and I said let's wait until we talk about state issues. The Senate did reconfirm DOT Secretary, I want to say Frank Buzalaki, but I was told that you actually properly should pronounce his last name, Buzalacci. But anyway, I'm so used to saying Buzalaki that I probably will continue to do that. He said any good Italian pronounces it Buzalacci. Now, of course, I'm not saying it the way he wants me to, but he was reconfirmed despite questions over why he was helping Kenosha businessman Troja with some tax issues with out-of-state trucking companies and wondering whether he was doing that because Troja was such a big campaign contributor to Governor Doyle's campaign. Did you think that confirmation should have been postponed?
Well, interestingly, I brought that up not because I have strong opinions on that one way or another. I'm simply, making an analogy. That is to say, if we're going to be constantly investigating people on ethics charges, we need to be even-handed in it. And whether I, frankly, do not know enough about this case, and I suspect that probably almost no one knows enough about this case to know whether there was anything amiss there or not. Could it have been political influence? Well, in the Doyle administration, it absolutely could have. Officials in any tax-gathering agency sometimes say, this has been a huge hassle, let's negotiate something and move on to something else. They do sometimes say that, and sometimes it's a legitimate policy call. So I don't know. I think if I had my druthers, I want to see it investigated a bit. Maybe investigated independent of his confirmation. But the Republicans don't control the Senate.
Lewis Fortas?
First of all, we'll just call him Frank so I can avoid the last name problem. We were very critical of him when he was first appointed by Doyle for that position, just due to things that occurred when he had his previous job as a labor leader. And also, when you first read the headlines of this current situation, I think you couldn't help but be kind of outraged by the situation, at least the way it was originally kind of presented in the daily paper. And then after doing some investigation, it appears that they had very little choice. They had signed a multi-state pact, and it was the responsibility of the state of Wisconsin in this particular case to negotiate with these other states. So I don't think there was much choice. The interesting thing, if I were Judy Robson, I might have held it up for a week or something just to let people talk a little more before and see if there's anything else comes up. But the interesting thing to me is that more than half of the Republicans supported the reconfirmation of Frank. So I don't think it was that political an issue.
Okay. Some caller was just going to talk on this, but just hung up. So let me move forward to the state Supreme Court justice race. I wanted to know if either of you had any comments on the news that is breaking this week about Washington County Judge Annette Ziegler's not stepping down from cases or disclosing that her husband was on the West Bend Bank's board of directors when she was hearing cases involving that West Bend Bank, and then another State Journal series of articles saying that she heard cases involving companies that she owned a lot of stock in. The other side, Linda Clifford's side, is pointing to these as you know, questionable, that she had conflicts of interest. Are these a big deal, Professor McAdams?
Well, you have to make some distinctions. In terms of her owning stock in something, there's no absolute rule or state statute requiring her to recuse herself unless the involvement is more than de minimis, that is to say, unless it's actually substantial. So the stock is sort of a non-issue. Interestingly, the corporate people hired a private investigator to go after her, and the first things the private investigator turned up and they made an issue of were simply stock ownership, which was really not a big deal. Interestingly, Linda Clifford herself has done legal work for the Wisconsin State Journal, which is attacking Ziegler, and has a husband who is, in fact, a lobbyist for the trial lawyers, medical malpractice. And she has expressed the opinion quite clearly that the liberal majority on the court, when they struck down malpractice caps, were right about that. Not recusing herself from the case involving West Bend Savings is a bit more of an issue, although a lot of these things were in small claims court and were utterly routine. So I would like, you know, the people on the other side, if they really want to say this is a huge ethical lapse, to in fact suggest any case where they think that she showed a bias that came out the way it shouldn't have come out, because this is all in fact, because the small claims court stuff is terribly routine, often involving nothing more than the minimal intervention of a judge just to sign off on something a clerk did.
Louis Fortas?
Okay, well, I've had the opportunity to meet Annette on a couple of occasions. She stopped at the Shepherd office. You know, she's bright, she's charming, she's all that stuff. But at the same time, this is not a trivial matter. This is a highly, highly serious matter. When you go before a judge, for this system to work, for our democracy to work, you want an unbiased judge. And when you have someone who has a personal financial interest in a case and fails to disclose it, not only are you kind of concerned that she's not qualified to be a Supreme Court justice, but you begin to question whether she should be on any bench. And that's hard to say, again, because she's a very nice person, but this is serious stuff. And John is wrong on three parts. First of all, the Clifford campaign did not hire that private investigator. He's somebody that freelances. We've dealt with him on a number of occasions. He works for now another organization. So he's was not hired by the Clifford campaign. Her husband is not a lobbyist. He's an attorney in Madison. He was involved with the, I think he was president of the trial lawyers at one point, but certainly not a lobbyist. And finally, the State Journal that he was attacking is a very Republican newspaper. I mean, this is not a liberal newspaper. The Cap Times is a liberal one, John, as you know. The State Journal is a very conservative paper. And for them to come out as strongly as they did means that this is not a trivial matter. So I think it's very serious. We'll see what else comes out on this. But this is more than also small claims. There were a number of major cases, and I think people are now coming forward saying, wait a second, you know, I had no idea when I was up against this bank that the judge had a personal financial interest in the outcome of this case. So that is serious, and we'll see what happens on this.
Yeah. We have not done a whole lot on the Stephen Avery trial, but I guess the jury is deliberating as we speak. A verdict could come, who knows, any time. Is this a trial, Louis Fortas, that you've been watching and you think you know, has any issues that we should discuss here?
It's not something I've been watching very closely because I see no, you know, larger public policy issues here. The only thing I do know, probably two things. One is the media, most of the media, or many of the media, have already convicted him, and you know, that may be the correct decision. I don't know. But the other thing is they did that before, about 20 years ago, and he was innocent on that one. So I realize that you know, it's hard to run around saying Avery's a great guy, but because he's been so vilified. But I don't know. I just don't know. And I would like to see, you know, we'll wait to see what happens with the jury on this. But I know that there have been some, the judge has ruled in a couple of instances where they've kept certain evidence out of the case. So I'm assuming that he's going to probably end up convicted.
Any thoughts on this case, John McAdams?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with Louis Fortas that there probably aren't any larger public issues. What you have is the defense, in effect, claiming a sort of pretty large, pretty extensive police conspiracy to convict him, to frame him. I think that's what you try when you can't raise a reasonable doubt by any other means. But who knows? The jury will decide.
But here's the deal, John. I mean, in this case, you know, you can't be saying it's some kind of crazy conspiracy. I mean, this guy spent 18 years in jail falsely convicted of something. Everyone agrees with that now. I mean, the state even paid him some money because of that. And, you know, so to say that he may be falsely accused here is not over the top. Again, is he guilty? I have no idea. But to argue that the lawyers are building some kind of crazy conspiracy case, you know, they did it once to him, you know, is this not a fantasy?
Well, let me just simply ask, was he in fact framed the first time, or was he simply a victim of circumstances?
They certainly fought any kind of efforts to find him innocent, which they ultimately lost, and he was found innocent in the past. So,
but that's a different issue.
Well, no, it's hiding, it's covering a mistake.
Just a couple of minutes left to go. I have a couple of minor issues I can bring up, but I wanted to know, starting with you, John McAdams, briefly, is there anything that happened in the news this week that we haven't talked about or that you want to follow up on?
Oh, not particularly. Okay. Let's pass it on to Lewis.
Yeah, Lewis, how about you?
About. No, I think you covered probably the more important ones.
All right. Well, then here's a real quickie. Wisconsin's worst sex offenders might become easier to spot. A Republican lawmaker this week introduced a bill that would force child molesters and sexually violent offenders to place bright green license plates on their vehicles. What do you think of that idea, Professor McAdams?
Well, I don't know. I think it's kind of wacky. I think the bill that Doyle signed and campaigned on, that is to say, GPS tracking of sex offenders. He campaigned on having signed a tough bill about that, then refused to fund it in his budget. I think that policy would probably be pretty good. I'm afraid where sex offenders real pedophiles are concerned, we really can't expect them to be rehabilitated or maybe not even properly deterred. Mm-hmm. So this kind of incapacitation, this kind of surveillance, is probably the best strategy.
30 seconds, Lewis Fortas.
First of all, I mean, the child molesters are definitely kind of monsters in our society. There's no question about that. But, I mean, how much are politicians, and I'm disappointed in Joel Clefish on this one, how much are they going to posture on this? It's usually a legislator that doesn't have much going in real accomplishments that begins to kind of fall back on these things. So,
we'll have to
Joel, we're disappointed in you.
We'll have to leave it there. Lewis Fortas and John McAdams, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Lewis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express, and John McAdams, professor of political science at Marquette University. Thanks to Leo Duran and Cheryl Gasser for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.